And here we go. So what we're going to be focusing on today is an angle or a subtext of the Megillah, which I would argue that without thinking in this particular direction, you would not even realize the Megillah is actually making an argument about. It's really just an amazing angle, which I don't think that most people pay attention to even notice. Here's how it goes. So this is one angle that got me thinking. And again, remember, we always remember that as we learn Torah, we process it based on the experiences that we're going through in our own lives. So as an example, like, we go through certain things and then suddenly we see a Torah idea speaks to us a little more than it used to, because right now that's where we're at. And I think for me, this is certainly true. And I'll try to expand on that idea. And I hope that it resonates as well. So what got me thinking on this idea was the following halacha. I happened to be reading through Shulchan Aruch on the laws of the Feast of Purim. And I want to also just thank the Doctors Leon and Alan Wiesenfeld, who are sponsoring this shiur, Leilui Nishmas Rabbi Marvin Balsam, Pinchas Matisyahu ben Yosef Mordechai, Olav HaShalom, whose yahrzeit is going to be this coming week just after Purim, Nishmasai Eden. It was the Wiesenfelds who got me thinking about this idea to develop it into its full fruition today. So the Ramah tells us, in talking about the halachas of Purim, because remember, this Purim is going to be an unusual one, with the Seudah being a little earlier than usual and so on. In and amongst that, there's a very unusual halacha. And here it is. It says, Yesh Omrim, there's an opinion, Sheyesh le'echol ma'achal zeronim ba'purim. You should eat something which has seeds in it on Purim. Zecher le'zeronim she'achal Daniel v'chaveiro b'Bavel. As a remembrance of the seeds that were eaten by Daniel and his contemporaries in Babylon. That's quoted by the Sefer Kolbo. The Kolbo is one of the Rishonim, one of the medieval commentators who brought this down and is codified into law. So if you're ever wondering, I know that's it's less popular these days, but certainly when I was growing up, Humantashen always had poppy seeds in them. And that is not just because of their we'll call it psychotic effect on a person. This is not an alternative for alcohol. The point is that it's actually in remembrance to Daniel. Okay, so you say to yourself, what is this talking about? The seeds of Daniel. What has Daniel got to do with Purim? So that's what got me thinking. And the reason why it's got me thinking is because just recently, I spent the time learning the Sefer Daniel. So for those of who are joining with me this year, we learned Sefer Daniel earlier this year, and so I know precisely what's going on over here. Let's take a look at that quickly. So it turns out this is the topic of the entire first perek of Sefer Daniel. We're not going to read the entire thing, but just a general background as to what's happening. Daniel is a young person who lives in Yerushalayim, a very prestigious person, comes from Yichus, has a great amount of talents. He and his friends are kidnapped from Yerushalayim by the Babylonians before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. If you remember, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in different stages or in different sequences. So, the exile of Babylonia. Babylon rose as an empire very fast, took over the entire Middle East, and certain smaller states like the state of Judea banded together with other smaller countries like Egypt and Ammon and Edom as an alliance against the rising power of Babylon, to their chagrin. They shouldn't have done that. Yirmiyahu told them they shouldn't do it. They didn't listen. And Jehoiakim, who was the king at the time, ardently fought against them and ultimately was exiled and killed himself. So it's at this point in time that one of their policies is they go to Jerusalem, they ransack Jerusalem, and they take among them the young Jewish blood to go and educate them in schools in Babylonia, right? To cultivate them as perhaps let's take the best of each society, and that's what they do. So the king says, this is in Pasuk Gimon Sefer Daniel. Vayomer HaMelech, this is Nebuchadnezzar says, L'Ashpenaz, Rav Sarisav, to his chief officer, Lo'avim b'nei Yisrael mizera melucha min hapartamim. He goes and wants to see. He wants the royal seed, so he wants sort of like the greatest four front runners in Jerusalem society, and that's what happens. He says that children who look good, who are skilled, who are knowledgeable, who are going to come in, they're going to be taught the laws and the language of the Chaldeans, right? Lashon Kastim. Okay, so that's what happens is they bring them out, and there are three young men who are pulled out. Their names are Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah. Okay, those are the four men who are young boys, probably in their teens, who are taken from Jerusalem. They are given Babylonian names. Their names are now Belshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Avadnego. Okay, so they're given, those are Babylonian names. They are rebranded, essentially, and they're educated within the greatest and most elite of Babylonian schools. While this is happening, they're also offered mipas bag hamelech. So they're given stipend and board and the portion of the king's food. Right, so they're going to be drinking with us, and this is a process. This is a induction process of 3 years that they're going to be going, so they can, going through, so that they can now be officers of the king. Okay, so this is the way of doing it. Now, Daniel is the leader of these three, of these four, and what he does is he realizes that he doesn't want to be living off the king's table. First of all, because it is treif food; it is not kosher. So he turns over to the Sar Hasarisim, to the chief of the officers, and he says to him, why do we have to eat this food? And this officer is a little concerned. He doesn't want to get involved in this conversation, because if his charge, which is looking after these young men, is not going to be fulfilled, his head will be in his hands, disconnected from his neck within just the span of a few seconds. And Nebuchadnezzar wasn't a very patient individual. You know, patience was not one of his virtues. He massacred people, you know, for less than that, this, if you carry on reading, say, for Daniel. So then Daniel has another conversation with the Meltzar. So the Malbim points out that no longer is he speaking to the chief, he speaks to the Meltzar, which is sort of the waiter, or the person who's more directly involved. And he makes the following request. He says the following, and this is in Pasuk Yudbeis. He says, Nas no es avodecha. He says, try us, yamim asara, for just 10 days. V'yitno lanu min hazeronim, v'noichela umayim v'nishte. So we're not going to have the fancy meat and bread from the king's table. We're not going to have the wine out of his decanters. We'll have basic zeronim seeds and water to drink. Try it for 10 days and see what happens. See if it's so terrible, what ends up happening. So what happens? We hear this, and that's what they indeed do. And what a miracle happens, or it's pretty amazing, is that at the end of 10 days, we hear Nir'a Marehem Tov, Ubri'e Bosar Mina Yeladim Ha'achrim Es Paspag HaMelech. In fact, they look more healthy than the rest of the students who are eating off of the king's table. So their suggestion succeeds wildly, and they carry on with this program. And ultimately, though, we're told that in the end of the parak, Vayaladimo Ele Arbaatan, these four young men, they understood all the wisdom of Babylonia, and Daniel became a great understander of dreams, as we'll see later on in Daniel. And we hear about how they rise in the ranks of the king. Okay, so we hear that ultimately that we call devar bina chachmas bina asher bikesh mehim amelech veinsoem eser yadois al kol hachartumim haashafim asher b'chol malchusai. He is now 10 times better than any of the others who are inducted with them from the other vassal states of the king. Okay, so this is the story. So this is what the Shulchan Aruch is referring to. Why is it that we eat seeds? There's a minhag to eat seeds, certainly on the night of Purim. Why is that some of those who intashen have the poppy seeds in them? Is because of this story, which has to do with Daniel, as he was able to, as a young teenager, stand by his own standards. That is what's being referred to. Okay, so that's the background of what the Kolboy was saying and what the Ramah is codifying. Now I ask you, what does that have to do with Purim? Right, so why is that the minhag of Purim? This is a very beautiful story. It's a very incredible story. But in the end of the day, why Purim? So it is interesting. The Gemara in Megillah actually relates to this, and this is where the Kolboy is based on. And the Gemara says, and this is a famous idea, but perhaps we haven't heard the full ramifications of this idea. The Gemara says in Daf Yud Gimel the following. It says it's talking about how Esther is provided with the Sheva Na'arois, seven maidens. So the Gemara says the following, Amar Rava, Shoyes Amoneh Bohem Shabbos. So why did she have seven maidens? Because that was a way of keeping the count of the days of the week and where Shabbos would be. So each one, she'd know which day of the week would be. There would be one maiden, that would be a Shabbos maiden. Okay. Vayashaneh Vesanarasel. And it says, she advanced or she changed with her through her maidens. Amar Rav Sheichilo Ma'achal Yehudi. She had Jewish food. Bagels, lox, I don't know, Chalent on Thursday night. Not sure. The Gemara says Ushmul Amar Shechila Kadale the Chaziri, right? Because they really wanted to. They wanted to give a pig's hinds. You know, that was their attempt. They were this delicacies in Babylonia. Zeronim. What was it that she ate? Zeronim. That's our important word here. Seeds. Why the chenu omer vayam elza nosei pas bagam v'nosei lohem zeronim. Thereby quoting a pasuk from which sefer? From Sefer Daniel. That's our quote. So what's the connection to sefer to Megillas Esther? Is just like Daniel in Sefer Daniel was able to hold his own in the palace of the king and eat a parav type of food, seeds which had no less of an issue. So too, the times of Esther, she was able to be able to do this. Now, today, I don't know, today it gets even more complicated because, poppy seeds, wait a second, is that a buggy issue? So anyways, but nonetheless, we're going to move away from that particular topic. Nonetheless, they were able to hold their own. And that's why it is that just like Daniel, Esther was able to do this. In fact, the Kavachayim in his Pirushon Shulchan Aruch pointed out that even there's one more connection between these two, and that is that in fact Hasach, according to many, is according to Chazal, is in fact Daniel. So Hasach was, remember, that intermediary between her and Mordechai, and so perhaps he was the one himself who gave her the chizuk or the idea of eating zeronim, of eating these seeds, and that's how she survived ultimately. Okay, so this is item number one. So I'd like to think about this from the perspective: is what is it? What is the Daniel narrative teaching us about the Esther narrative? What is it? It's not just that there's the same person and the same methodology. There's something else that's going on over here. What's the general theme? So I would like to scan outwards or zoom outwards a little bit now to the earliest part of the story. And here's the curious part about the story. We're focusing on a different idea, which I think actually coalesces with the idea we just learned. So we're closing the idea of eating seeds on Purim, and now we're moving to the second parak of the Megillah, where we hear about now the king in his drunken stupor has assassinated his wife, executed his wife. He's now trying to rectify it by essentially, creating a harem to express his physical desires and find a new wife. I mean, this is the height of immorality, this corrupt, drunken individual. But nonetheless, we hear that you can imagine what it would be like to be a Jewish family hearing about this new edict that all maidens have to be taken to the royal palace. You can imagine how we would respond, and certainly if we had daughters in the parasha, this would be something which would be very, very concerning for us. And that was really Mordechai's reaction. So we hear it this following: "Vahi b'shama dvar hamelech v'dasoi v'yikovetz naraz rabbi sol shushana b'riyah el yad hegai v'tilokach Esther al beis hamelech el yad hegai shomer anoshim." So Esther is abducted; she's taken out. This is important to notice. The word over here, "v'tilokach," is a word of coercion. This is not a choice. She's not a teenage girl, thinking that this is a rock star and she's trying to get his autograph. She very much was forcibly removed. And in this, Mordechai gives her instructions. Now you have to try to imagine yourself, if you're the parent, if you're the guardian, what words of advice would you offer this young, vulnerable person now being pulled to the king's harem? So the answer is that we hear in the next pasuk, "Lo hi gida Esther es amo ve es molalato, ki Mordechai tziva aleha asher lo isaged." She Mordechai gave her parting instructions. You can even imagine this may have been the last message he says to her as she's being dragged out by the police officers of Persia. Don't say where you come from. And that's what happens. She doesn't say where she comes from. She's able to maintain that. And then Mordechai goes and spends time in the Chatzar Beis HaMelech to make sure that she's all right. So the question is, like, why would that be the advice? Why is this the most critical piece of advice that Mordechai can offer to Esther at this moment, at this critical moment in time? So the Mefarshim debate this in many ways. I'd like to look at three different perspectives, and each of them, I think, actually yield a little bit of light. So just skipping this section here for a moment to Rashi. Rashi says a very fascinating thing. This perhaps is our most common way of looking at it, is why. Kedei shiyamru shehi mimshpacha bezuya v'shalchua. When somebody doesn't tell their lineage, usually it means there's a problem. Usually it means it's something she is trying to hide. So Mordechai is trying to get her rejected. So by her hiding her identity, they'll say there's probably something wrong here. And they'll ultimately, they'll reject her candidacy. If they knew that she had royal blood in her, that might have been a reason to ultimately keep her. Okay, so Mordechai's attempt over here is to manipulate the decision-making process by presenting something which is going to be seen as a demerit in her in against her favor. That's the way that the Rashi looks at it. Now, the Ibn Ezra presents a idea which seems to be almost diametrically opposite idea, but I think they actually are the same. And then he has how it goes. He says the following, and this rings true as well, and that is that ulai im tagid shehi migalus Yehuda lo yikachenu achashverosh. If he knows that she is a Jewish refugee, which ultimately her family is, then he would never have taken her in, because she's this refugee foreigner, accent comes from backwards, you know, Judea, so they would have thrown her out, right? So ultimately this sounds like the opposite. It sounds like the intention of Mordechai is to get her in the door. Maybe he wants her to be this the queen at the right moment, for whatever purposes. And therefore he's not disclosing or asking her not to disclose ultimately gives her merit. So it seems like this is the opposite idea, but I would argue that both Rashi and the Ibn Ezra have the same basic assumption. And that basic assumption is that Mordechai is trying to manipulate the political decision-making. One is against Esther's candidacy, the one is for her, but ultimately it's the same logic, which is that Mordechai is trying to manipulate the circumstance and not leave it simply to the way the cards will fall. Okay, so that's this we'll call Avenue 1. Avenue 2 is that if we look at this from a historic perspective, you'll notice that, in fact, Israel, B'nai Israel, are very reticent to just talk about their family when it comes to being in foreign neighborhoods. So the first time we can think about, you know, our tradition, our patriarchs and matriarchs being in a foreign culture actually comes all the way back to Parshas Lech Lecha. And in Parshas Lech Lecha, when Avram Avinu is now traveling with Sarah Imenu, and they're coming to Egypt, the one thing he tells her is, he already starts telling her, Imri no acho esiyat. Remember, he says, don't disclose our full relationship. Don't tell exactly how we're related to each other. He feels safer because based on the immorality of Egypt, the way they're going, he feels safer with less disclosure. In fact, similarly with Yitzhak, the next generation, Yitzhak's going to grow to the area of Gaza. What does he say? He says, "Vayomer achosihi ki orei lemor ishti penyargunyan shemakom al rivka." He's worried that he'll be, assassinated to have his wife abducted. So he says, "No, maybe say you're my sister." So already the mentality of our patriarchs, our matriarchs, going into foreign territory is being a little more circumspect when it comes to who we are and our real backgrounds. Later on, pushing it to the third generation, when Yaakov Avinu sends his sons, he's forced because of the famine to send his sons to Egypt. He sends 10 sons with the exclusion of Binyamin and Yosef. Yosef because he's gone. Binyamin because he wants to protect him. And then they go down and they go through different gates and they try to sort of be nondescript. And then they're all pulled together. Yosef accuses them of espionage. And there's this whole debate that goes on back together. He retains Shimon. They go back. They run out of food again. And now they're forcing Yaakov's hand. They're saying, Yaakov, we need to go back because we need food. But he says, but I don't want you to go back. And they said, but we need Binyamin because we can't appear without him. And Yaakov Avinu says this very painful statement. Why did you say you had a brother? Why did you mention you had another brother at home? If you just kept quiet, if you just said it's us, you know, and you didn't get into the conversation about your family, your background, your genealogy, and he has the family tree, then you would never be in the situation in the first place where he's forcing you. And Yehuda goes on to explain, they all explain to him, look, we didn't know when he asked us about the Mishpacha, we didn't know that was what he was getting at, but this is what he said. We're going to know that this is what his intent was. So again, you see this reluctance to be so forthcoming. And in fact, says the Haimek Davar, Rav Natali Yehuda Berlin, when it comes to the Jew in the diaspora, says the Haimek Davar, Ksiv Kan Shem Yisrael. Did you notice that out of all the time when Yosef is not around, his name is Yaakov? Why is he called Yisrael in this pasuk where it says Vayom Yisrael to his sons? Kibok Bakan Lelamdom. This is to teach us a lesson. Das Ledoros, knowledge for the generations. Haboim, the future ones. Asher Yiyu Begalus, when we ourselves are in the diaspora, when we're in exile. Vayamdul Yos Nishpat Lifnei Adonim Sheloi Ledaber Yoser Me'at Teshuvah Al Hashual. Don't advocate. Don't disclose. Just answer the questions that are asked. That's it. Yaakov's telling us a mode of operation when it comes to being a diaspora Jew. We're not going to be too engaged. We're going to be more careful about the way we say things. In fact, sort of taking off on this idea, the Ma'aral in his Pirush Nagara called the Or Chadash says a very fascinating thing. And he says, what is the concern of not telling her birthplace? He says, because ki im hay sa magedes amo malatoy, if she were to have told where she came from, hay Mordechai choshesh, Mordechai was concerned, ki she yihiyu yereim ha'umois, she'amalkot tegadel malato al kol asarim. What's going to happen is all the Persians are going to say, ah, this Jew is going to nepotistically bring in all her cousins and uncles and aunts and distant neighbors into the king's employ. Tashpil achirim and lower others. Now, in truth, it just is so funny when you say is that, you know, when Jews have entered foreign societies, they try so hard in every society to prove to that society that they really are a citizen of that society, whether it be Germany or Ukraine or Poland or France or England or Spain or America or South Africa or Australia. The Jews try so hard to prove that they're loyal to their culture, and the culture still rejects them. The culture always says they're going to be nepotistic, they're going to exclude us, they're going... It's the same in the conversation in every country. Oi, he says, Buula yiyu yureim kevon shamalko minayudim tia malko sonoes asher enana minuata. They say, ah, she's going to be anti-Semites, right? So she's going to hate all who are not Jews, which is amazing. It's a projection of their own feelings. The Jews, and you look in America, the Jews are not anti-non-Jews. It just doesn't work like that. They're trying to be as accommodating and as open-handed, armed as possible. It's the projection of we hate them, so they're going to hate us, which has been projected onto her. It's amazing. The Ma'aral is speaking the language we understand. And then she's going to convince the king over them and against them. And they feel that they, as natural-born citizens of Persia, have more rights to this position. And that why should this Jewish queen stab them in the back? So again, it's coming under the same perspective. This avenue of thought, the second avenue of thought. Rashi and the Ibn Ezra were saying Mordechai was trying to manipulate the political decision-making ideas, whether it's for or against. The Haim Ekdav and the Ma'aral are saying a very different idea, and that is that there's a concern that as a Jew in the diaspora, you're not going to be so forthcoming. We don't want to run around with that label saying, here is a Jew, because whether we do something right or we don't do something right, they're going to blame us. Under that label, that's what the Baha'i Mekdavar and the Or Chadash says. There's another possibility, a third avenue. We're going to close this idea in just a moment. The Rav Soloveitchik in his Megillah, it's actually beautiful. They just came out with something called Mesoris Arav and Megillas Esther, which is a few years ago, and he comments and makes the following interesting point. This is, it takes a lot of thought to appreciate this. He said the following: had Mordechai abandoned caution and adopted the attitude of the arrogant fool, had he let everybody know that he was related to the queen, he would have commanded their respect. Can you imagine this? Mordechai would have been the guest speaker at every dinner. He would have been invited to every Zoom address, you know, because he would be the Mr. connected to the queen, right? However, had he been proud and vain, had he boasted that he is a relation of the queen, the whole miracle would not have happened. The miracle was made possible by Mordechai's caution and humility. He was silent, humble. He was waiting for something to happen. He knew that the more fantastic the success story, the more vulnerable man is, and the more intense is the need for prayer. Vulnerability of man is proportionate to his greatness. The greater his success, the more vulnerable he is. Mordechai knew that as Esther climbed to the very heights of success, the deeper became the abyss into which she might plunge. Because of Mordechai's humility and because of his awareness of vulnerability and caution, the great miracle happened. In sum, vulnerability leads to humility, humility to caution, and caution leads to success. That's from Days of Deliverance, Rav Soloveitchik, culled here for the Megillah. Let's think about these ideas for a moment. Mordechai tells Esther, don't say where you come from. Don't reveal. And ultimately, if you think about that, it's counterintuitive. Why would he say this? Three avenues of thought. Number one, it's from the perspective of he's trying to manipulate the political decision-making, the Ibn Ezra Rashi. The Hamek Dover, the Or Chodesh, no, it's not about trying to manipulate things. It's just we have to be very cautious. As a Jew in the diaspora, our standing in society, sometimes it's not good to be so flagrantly and obviously taking power as a Jew. And number three is it's not about Esther, it's about Mordechai. It's his not willingness to be connected to her rather than her to him. And that's why is that? Because he realizes the danger that's involved in the high office, and also the importance of waiting for our Kodesh Baruch Hu and knowing to that one Davins. It's not just simply about being connected to that particular individual. Okay, as it goes, Elaine, you want to say something?
Yeah. So on the other hand, I don't know the order of things exactly, but if Mordechai had been a more important person, then maybe Haman wouldn't have had a reason to say, oh, he's not bowing down to me, he's greater than me, and he might not have done the whole Purim thing.
You're right. So I think what seems to be, it's almost as if what I would say is that the subtext of the Megillah is asking us a question. It's presenting a question. And that is what is the standing of a Jew in diaspora? That's really the question that's being raised to us. How significant is it to be prominent, and how dangerous is it to be prominent? Esther is being pulled in; she's being inducted into prominence without asking for it. So as she ascends this trajectory, is it good to be prominent as a Jew? Is it not good to be prominent as a Jew? How does it reflect on Mordechai? These are questions. There's no good answer at this point, but it seems that Mordechai is more hesitant. Now, to your point, in the next psukim, at the end is when she's told, just as an aside, in the psukim, as she's chosen, the king sees great favor in her, she has a chen about her. We're told that Vayasa Melech Mishteh Godol Chol Sarova Avadovis Mishteh Esther Vanachol Medinos Asova Yitin Vasos Kayara Melech. So a few things just to note in these psukim it seems a little counterintuitive that right after she's chosen, there's going to be this whole gathering of all the young maidens who are not yet been acquainted with the king. Why would that happen a second time? So the Gemara comments that each of these stages in these psukim are actually attempts of the king to leverage her to get the information. So as an example, he makes a big feast for her in order to avoid to reveal. So the Gemara says, Loi Galia, she didn't reveal her background. You know, you can imagine this is sort of the major, they said, we'd like to send invitations to your family. You know, we'd like to know what language interpreter we'd like. No, she doesn't take the bait. Then Vanachala Medinasa, he makes a tax break for her, which now people are going to be in her favor. Maybe now you'll tell. And the Gemara says, Loi Galia, shouldn't redeem. Then it says, Vayitzen Masas Kiyara Melech. And then he gives out gifts to all the different officers in her name. All these, we'll call these carrots to attempt to give her to disclosure, and she doesn't. Uvi Kobez B'Lusolos Shanias, says the Gemara, is what did he do? He actually asked Mordechai his advice. Mordechai, what do you think we should do? And Mordechai, the Gemara said, you know what you should do is pretend that you're going to have a real, you know, we'll call it a second round of the competition and gather all the young ladies again in an attempt to, not as a stick, but sorry, as a carrot, but as a stick to force her to reveal, and still not. And that's why it says Mordechai Yoshe B'Shar HaMelech, because Shar HaMelech, the gateway, is always the place where the judges sit, so he's now ascended in society. So Mordechai does ascend. He cannot ascend higher than Haman. Haman is manipulating the king at this point in time to being the second in charge. But Mordechai certainly does have a station in society, and is going to use that station in society as it goes forward. But nonetheless, Ein Esther Mageres. She's not telling it. Now, just I'm just going to put this as a footnote, but it's ironic. Remember, according to Rashi, Rashi says that the reason why he's trying to manipulate the circumstances is if she does not disclose where she's from, the king will probably think it a foul and think that she must come from some sort of compromised background, and he'll reject her. If you think about it for just a moment, let's say you are Achashverosh, and Achashverosh has a particularly sensitive spot when it comes to wives disobeying him, right? So, you know, like when he asks let's call her Vashti for a moment, to appear at his feast, and she says no, so he simply executed her. So you can imagine it's a little strange that he's attracted to somebody who keeps saying no to him. That's, you know, like we're not talking about a, you know, we'll call it collegiate, you know, relationship of equals here. You know, we're talking about the king of the of 127 states who's used to people saying yes before he asks the question. And now he's marrying a woman who's consistently saying no to him. It's a strange thing, right? So the answer to that, there's numerous answers. The one answer I saw in the Sefer by Kisuni Ladoras by Yehoshua Bachrach, he suggests that actually it was the opposite way around, because Vashti was this political figurehead. She, in fact, had Babylonian blood in her, and she who had the dibs to the throne, he married into the royal blood. So her no to him meant a whole lot more. It was very embarrassing because he was not able to, he didn't have power were it not for her. So really, ultimately, she held the keys. Her no to him was a terribly embarrassing thing, which is why he and his courtiers suggested her execution. Whereas Esther's cloudy background, the more she says no, the more obvious it seems that there's something wrong here. And the more obvious there's nothing wrong, the less of a threat it is to him as well politically. So just to put that in perspective, ultimately, if we go with Rashi's idea that Mordechai is trying to manipulate the political circumstances, I think it's fascinating that ultimately it backfires, because that's the reason why she's chosen. Okay, so just to put that all together. Now, let's circle back for a moment. We looked at two completely separate stories. We looked at Daniel and Esther, and Esther. And I think really there's a common theme between the two of them. And that is what does it look like to be a Jew who now is pulled into government in the highest levels of government? How do you act? How do you maintain identity at the same time as not call attention to yourself? This is really what essentially is the uniform question over here. And the Zeironim, the eating of those seeds, is perhaps what we eat on Purim, is a symbol of that conversation. Daniel became the highest courtier, the highest advisor to four kings, ultimately in his career, right? Starting with Nebuchadnezzar, and later on Belshazzar and Cyrus. He became a very powerful individual, but at the same time, he was able to maintain his own system of respect, his own culture. He was able to maintain his values through the Zeironim. The same thing happens with Esther. Esther as well, on the one hand, is able to maintain the Zeironim, which is the symbol of being able to, I eat my own food, I stand my grounds, I don't tell who I come from, and yet she was raised to be ultimately the most powerful woman in the entire world, in the known world at this point in time. So that balance is the balance of the diaspora Jew, what it means to be a diaspora Jew. Now, this obviously sheds a lot of light in the later conversation that happens when Mordechai pleads with Esther for her to reveal who she is, to use that as leverage to be able to make the request to the king. And ultimately, she creates two seudos where she invites the king and Haman, and ultimately uses her relationship with Achashverosh, uses her damsel in distress, essentially, to implicate Haman, and Haman is rid of because she reveals at the right moment where she is. So you have to imagine if you look at this as an inflection point, the Megillah starts off with Mordechai and Esther being much more careful about the advertising who they are, and the Megillah seems to be the development of the necessary times in power to be able to reveal who one is and what that means. And that seems to be part of the change, the release of the tension in the Megillah. If we fast forward, I'd like to continue this thought a little further forward into the Megillah itself, to Mordechai's rise to power, which he was obviously a courtier, and he was by the Shara Melech, and he was obviously respected, but he wasn't the highest at this point at the beginning. And there's this switch around that happens with Haman later on. He gets the house of Haman. And we hear this interesting thing. We all say this out loud when we're in Shul. This is one of the psukim we say out loud. Mordechai yotza milifnei ha-melech bilvush malchus tcheles v'chur v'ateres zohav gedola v'tachrich butz v'argamon v'ir shushan tzala v'samecha. He's wearing all this royal apparel, blue and white and gold and crown and robes of fine linen and purple. I mean, it's amazing, right? He looks royal and regal and very proudly Jewish and also very proudly a Persian politician. And there was great happiness and light and rejoicing. And this great simcha, and this is the first time the word is used, there are people becoming, making themselves Jewish. It's remarkable. So you say to yourself, wait a second, but let's contrast that to the beginning of the Megillah. At the beginning of the Megillah, it was all about hush hush, right? We don't want to don't talk about who you are, where you come from, what you're all about. Be a little more careful, as the Haymek Dara says. What changed? Why is this so important? You know, if we look at the inflection point being where imacharesh tacharish la'es kazois, don't be silent at this moment in time, because the revach v'atzal yamod liyodu imam makam acher. It seems that Mordechai has gone to the complete opposite extreme, where now he's very publicly displaying his power and grandeur. Why is this important? So what is important is to put this in perspective from a number of reasons. If you read the psukim that are immediately before this, in fact, what happens is that Esther and Mordechai come to the king and they say, "Oh, king, you know, it is true. We thank you. And you gave the house to Mordechai, and you executed Haman. That's all wonderful. But, you know, looking on the laws and the edicts of the king, it still looks like the edict is still out and there's still going to be genocide come next year." So the king says, "Well, look, there's a rule in Persia. And that is that anything that the king writes cannot be retracted. It's the rule. This law obviously makes a lot of sense in certain respects. And that is that you never take the law of the king with a grain of salt, because if it's said, it's said. There's no way of going back on it. It's almost like has a divine level of resonance that you're not going to be able to question it. Okay, so that puts us in a little bit of a bind, because the edict says that all the people who want to can kill the Jews. So what do they do? So the king makes a suggestion. He says, I can't invalidate the edict, but I can write another edict. So what does he do? So he writes he gives the ring to them, and here's what the second edict reads. Asher nasan amelach leyodim asher b'chol ir ve'ir lahakel v'alamod al hashem lashmid la'arog la'abed is kol chel medina hatzorim osam taf v'nashim mishalam lavoz. So now the Jews can all stand up to defend themselves and kill and loot anybody who's going to attack them. And it's the same day as the first edict. B'yom echad, b'yom echad, on the first day. It's going to be on the 13th of Adar, which is tonight and tomorrow. Okay. And they send this off, and they send it off on the fastest runners and the guests to all the Medina Samerach. So now let's just for a second. Imagine that you're the sheriff, right, in Yehupitzville, India, right? And you're under the Persian mandate, and you get this decree, and you open it up, and it's got the seal of the king, and it says, okay, all Jews to be killed on the 13th of Adar. You're like, okay, put on the calendar. You know, you tell the, you know, the executive assistant to make it, to give a reminder, to put up the genocide posters come Adar, so everybody can get out their pitchforks and axes. Okay. And then suddenly, if you're like a month or two later, you get another edict which says the Jews can, you know, defend themselves and kill all those who are going to kill them. So you ask yourself, can you just check the date? And you're like, you look on the calendar and it says, yeah, it's actually the same date that they're allowed to kill the Jews. So you're like, what's going on in Shushan, right? So what do? You pick up your Morse code telegraph line, and you reach out to your family in Shushan, and you say, tell me something. Who's in charge in Shushan? Like, what's going on here? Is it the Semites? Is it the anti-Semites, right? Like, who's in charge? Because whoever it is, that's the edict I'm following, right? Because I'm not sure what I'm going to put on my posters when it comes to Adar. Like, what's the festivities going to be like? Who's getting killed? So it's very hard to do. So this is exactly the plan. Now, so what's the first thing Mordechai does immediately after this edict is issued? Ooh, who's in charge now? Who's got the house of Haman? Who's walking around in the finest garments? Mordechai. So as that message comes in from India asking who's in charge, the answer is Mordechai. If Mordechai is in charge and he's a Jew, I get it. Okay, so we're going to PR the second edict, not the first edict. That's going to be the major point, and that's how it works. So ultimately, Mordechai's taking will cause very lavish, you know, presentation or self-presentation, in fact, is part of the plan to be able to elevate the second edict over the first edict, which makes a lot of sense. This is an idea I heard from Rav Stav when I was in Keren B'Yavne, and in fact, Rabbi David Foreman actually develops himself independently as well. So this idea makes a lot of sense. So which means to say, why is the Mordechai is going to all these lengths? The answer is, it's not because of, you know, his personal, you know, feathering his own pillow. It's because ultimately that's part of the necessary nature of avoiding genocide, of avoiding the massacre of all the Jews, is taking this very public office, very different to his first approach to how to deal with Persian government, which was not to command Esther not to get involved whatsoever. Okay, very different perspective. Now, even in and amongst this, the Chazal already point out to us that what was this Arav Simcha Vasasan Vikar The Gemara says, "Omar Rabbi Yehuda in on Megillah Daf Yud Tezayin on Beis." The Gemara says, "Omar Rabbi Yehuda, Ira Zu Tyra." What does Ira mean? That they had Ira. It doesn't mean to say it was because now they got political, collateral benefits from the fact that Mordechai was there and they could have events and they could get Mordechai's signature and he would be the keynote speaker at the local charity dinner. No, it wasn't. It was not what Ira was. Ira was Zutaira. And the Gemara then goes on to say, quotes a pasuk. And then it says, V'cheinu Omer, V'samat b'chakecha, Sason Zumila. The word Sason means that they kept the mitzvah mila. Yikar elu tfilin. Right? So it's meaning to say, what are all these words? What Chazal is saying is don't think that their joy and their celebration was as a function of the fact that now they had political clout and now if they needed somebody to get a passport, they would call up Mordechai and say, could you just give a little, push to the postal system so that we could get them in, and either there's a visa was an issue with a little bit, somebody getting into their vacation over Pesach in Africa, maybe you could. No, that was not what Mordechai's, that was not the success that the Jews are celebrating now. They had a yes man in the job. It was the fact that ultimately they're celebrating their uniqueness rather than the universal nature. That is what is happening over here. Just a different perspective. So Chazal already giving us a subtext to, on the one hand, being distinct, but at the same time, by necessity, being public and universal. That's the struggle that one sees over here. In fact, later on in the Megillah, as the Megillah closes, the very last pasuk of the Megillah is I didn't actually put the pasuk in, but the pasuk we all read out loud is Kimorachai Yehudi Mishnele Mechachash Rosh Gadol Uv La Yehudi Rotsui Leroy Bechov Dorish and then Dorish Shalom Chol Zaroy. So the pasuk we all say at the end of the Megillah is a Mordechai the Jew was a Mishnele Melech. That means to say he was a second to the king. He was served the Persian king, and he was great to the Jews and Rotsui Leroy Bechov. And he was accepted or appeased by a majority of his brethren. That sounds like a good Jewish leader. There's always somebody in the back who has a problem with you, right? So it's the Ratzoy L'Reivachov. Most of them were all right. Another one of them says, why didn't Mordechai make that Shachris should be earlier in Persia? There's always somebody that that's a general rule, is that if you're in klal work, there's always going to be somebody. So it's Ratzoy L'Reivachov. So that's but the Gemara says that's not what's going on. The Gemara says it was actually saying something more substantive to the fact that that it wasn't all of his brethren who accepted him. So it says why. He says, "V'loy lekolechov." The Gemara says, "Not to all his brethren." Some of the leaders of Klal Yisrael, the Sanhedrin, in fact, sort of retracted from him. The Gemara doesn't give us a reason why necessarily explicitly, but the next point in the Gemara actually is very helpful in trying to untie this. And that is Omar of Yosef, Godel Talmud Torah, Yosef Me'atzolus Nefashas. It's more important to be involved in learning Torah than, in fact, saving lives even. Now, that's the halacha, that's more complex, but ledemei kara chashev leila Mordechai basar arba ulevasoev basar chamisha. At the beginning, Mordechai was listed after four and later on after five. What does that mean? These are actually psukim in Sefer Ezra, where it describes mei kara ksiv asher bauim zerubavel yeshua nechemia soraya ra'al yo Mordechai bilshan. So when it describes one of the aliyah's attempts to go to Israel under the leader Zerubbabel, Mordechai is one of those people, and he's listed fourth. However, but later on, Ksiv Haboim im Zerubbabel, Yeshua, Nechemia, Azariah, Ramya, Nachmeni, Nachmani, and Mordechai Bilshan. And that's the pasuk that's in Nechemia, relating to the same episode. So Mordechai is pushed one step later. Why? So the Gemara says the logic is that it's more important to be involved as a Torah leader than it is to be necessarily a political leader who can afford Hatzolos Nefashos. Now, the Gemara obviously does not mean that literally in the sense that, Mordechai should not have saved the soul. He should not have stepped into the gap and saved the nation of Israel. What it seems to be is perhaps there's a commentary on the last pasuk on the Megillah, which is Rotzoi L'Roi V'Echov. Why did the Sanhedrin Pirushum Imenu? Is because he remained a Mishneh Lamelech. He remained this political figure after the events. Now, you could argue and say, no, it's really important to have a Mordechai in this office because should there be future Hamans, we want to make sure that we're going and we can all make that Cheshbon. The Gemara is saying, not everybody thought that was an appropriate action. Not everybody thought that was appropriate. Coming back to the same question, coming back to the Zeronim, to the seeds. Daniel, on the one hand, is going to maintain his uniqueness as he also ascends into the office of power. Mordechai says to Esther, don't say who you are. You're going to eat your own food. You're not going to reveal your identity. You're going to be distinct, right? And the humility of not being connected to her as well. There's an inflection point in the Megillah. They have to, so to speak, come out of the closet and show who they are and be happy with their nationality as part of the salvation. And Mordechai does so even when it comes to how he dresses to show that ultimately the Jews are in charge and this is going to save the Jews. Yes, all of this is incredibly important. But after all the storm is simmered down and everything's fine, Mordechai continues to be that person. And the Gemara is saying that it's Roy Vechov. Not every thought that he should have continued, as useful, as fantastic, as beneficial as that could have been. It happens to be just recently, I was reading an article, and somebody sent this to me, and I read it in Hamodia. Hamodia, you know, has a very wide base and has struggles to sort of, you know, try to present mainstream ideas to sometimes when there's a lot of extremists in certain directions. And they had an interview with Rav Brudny recently after this whole, you know, election and this whole episode on January 6th and so on. And I thought it was a really, really worthwhile article, really worthwhile perspective, because sometimes you'll hear people saying, how is it that you can possibly say that anything went wrong in the Trump administration? Because after all, it's a lack of hakaras hatov. You're not appreciating all the good things he did. So he was asked that question, and he answered a discussion about bifurcating Hakaras HaTov, of the idea of appreciating the good. He said the following, he quotes this, the following story. He says, more than a century ago, there was a yeshiva that went through a difficult period. The leader of another yeshiva helped them by supplying staff and talmidim to establish the said yeshiva and its leader on firm footing. As time passed, the Rosh Yeshiva called in visiting Talmidim and thanked them, but told them it was time for them to leave since his path in running the yeshiva was diverged from their path. The guests expressed surprise. After everything we did for you, where's your Hakaras HaTov? They asked. The Rosh Yeshiva's answer applied to our situation as well. In the entire Inyan of Hakaras HaTov, we only find that the receiver of a favor must recognize and thank the giver. However, we did not find that he must give back the favor. If I were to keep you here in my yeshiva, it would terminate the core of my yeshiva as I envision it, and that is not included in Hakaras HaTov. This idea applies here as well. As I said, we certainly appreciate the acts President Trump has done, and of course we internalize that the Abishta chose him to accomplish what he did. And we are grateful to him for that. But Hakaras HaTov does not obligate us to return and undo the tova that was done. The public exhibition of blind adulation towards the president with a refusal to recognize his shortcomings during the past 4 years and over the last 3 months is difficult to understand. And the image that we are presenting to the public at large impairs our ability to thrive in this Malchus Shel Chesed. And here's the line which I thought was so meaningful as well. In addition, as I said many times before, it is vital for us to remember that we remain in Golus and we should not take public role in determining the political direction of the country. That's a very fascinating perspective. This is from Rav Brudny. And I thought it's something which is worthwhile thinking. I'll tell you, and I'll full disclosure, I am fully behind AIPAC and NORPAC, and I go to Washington, D.C., and it's important to have relationships and to try to bring education about Judaism and the importance of our values in Israel to those in public office. There's no question. I'm fully behind that. But I think it's time to think also for us to take a pause and to consider this perspective to this idea. And Mordechai tried this perspective at the beginning, and he tried not to tell Esther, don't get involved, don't tell, don't try to. Maybe according to Rashi and Ibn Ezra, maybe he was trying to manipulate it, maybe he was trying to manipulate her out or in, depending which way you look at it. And ultimately, at a certain point, they had to take more of a public role. But then there's a question, is how long should that public role last? When do they recede back into the community? Daniel as well. Daniel also receded later on in his life. And ultimately, according to some, sort of recessed from his public role and was just learning and involved in spiritual pursuits as well. Very complicated questions. Very complicated questions because they're relevant to us today. They're relevant to us. These questions are begged of us each time. How much confidence do we have in those Jewish individuals who rise up in the ranks and how proud we are of them? At the same time, did we forget Hashem in the equation, that Hashem is also involved? How public should we be? How much backlash will there be every time a decision is made by that person? These are complicated questions. There's no we'll call it exact answer. But I think as we eat seeds, this Purim, Emet Hashem, when we come back to our home in Tashin with poppy seeds in them, we should think to ourselves, what is the role of that Jew in Golus? The distinctness and the universalism at the same time, the public role and the private role, and maintaining the balance between the two. I think this is something which demands a sophisticated and thoughtful conversation.